Went to sourdough starter school. Here's everything I learned. A story and country and townhouse. Here's a loose fact. 90% of the time, a rom-com heroine is a magazine journalist. The other 10% of the time, she is a baker. Ignoring my long-standing relationship with a fantastic partner, I have the former down pat. But should journalism fail to pan out, and with the current media landscape, this is not improbable, it seems inevitable I'll have to become a baker. There's one problem. I am a terrible baker. Like everyone in lockdown, I tried my hand at bread making. The results were dense and inedible, and my sourdough starter never made it past infancy. Thankfully, attendance at a sourdough starter school offered a chance to redeem myself, and perhaps my rom-com arc. I arrive for a brisk 90-minute session on preparing that tricky starter, keeping it healthy and baking with it, guided more by the smell of freshly baked bread than Google Maps, at Bread Ahead's Borough Market Bakery, where I am met by Andy, a professional baker and our knowledgeable instructor. The first step is meeting Bruce, Bread Ahead's very own sourdough starter, or rather an offshoot of Bruce. It is from this starter, named for a local parish deacon who blessed the starter with holy water in 2013 upon its inception, that all of our sourdoughs will be formed. Andy has us sniff the beige sludge and take in the sharp vinegar smell. He explains that this and the holes in the paste is a result of fermentation, alcohol, acids and carbon dioxide. Bruce is a rye flour starter, chosen for being both gut-friendly and a more forgiving medium than its white flour equivalent. Andy runs us through the stages of building a starter and preparing a loaf. To create your own, you mix equal parts light rye and water. Cover loosely in a jar and leave it overnight at room temperature. Repeat this process daily without discarding for 5 days until it bubbles to life. From then on, you can feed it weekly or fortnightly with a 1:1:1 ratio of starter, flour and water. If you don't want an industrial quantity of sourdough, starter, multiplying in your kitchen, bake with or discard a portion at each feed. 40 grams is a good base. Andy explains that from here it is a 3-day process to make any loaf of sourdough. Feed your sourdough as above, 2 nights before baking, then let it grow overnight. The next day, create, following any recipe, and leave in the fridge covered to prove overnight in a banneton or floured bowl. On day 3, you can bake, ideally in a blazing hot oven, maximum temperature at home. In a Dutch oven or with a baking hood. A marathon perhaps, but some good news, there's no kneading involved, so my previous problem of dense loaves, thanks to underdeveloped gluten, the result of poor kneading, there's no worry. Finally, Andy insists we name our starters, the reason being that guilt will act as our motivator at home to keep them alive. Mine is christened Bruce von Brucington III, and I head home with my beige goo to continue the experiment. At home, I find it surprisingly simple. Armed with Andy's explanation to feed my starter, and baking the loaf is almost foolproof. Still, I manage to underproof the dough and forget to cover the dough in the fridge overnight. It's wonky, certainly, but it smells and tastes like a sourdough bowl I might pick up in the supermarket. Maybe I'll never woo a ruthless and ambitious city trader with my offer of nostalgic rustic bread. I'm not really sure I want that either, but my partner is certainly chuffed that I can finally turn out an edible loaf.
It's going to be Death by Hummus by John Pawsey in Farmers Weekly. With spring drilling now complete, our attention has been diverted to inter-row hoeing our organic winter crops and mowing fertility lays for the first time to knock a few overzealous weeds on the head and give maximum light to the clovers. Typically, we farmers around Shimpling are now starting to whinge about the lack of rain. Hoeing blades are being punished by our cracked, hand-sloped soils and are being replaced with more frequency than budgeted for. That, coupled with the fight in the Middle East, has edged our overhead costs into eye-watering territory. Among the usual farm trials we repeat here annually, we have a new one this year with NIAB, the National Institute for Agricultural Biology, and my favourite Cambridgeshire farmer, David White. We are bi-cropping, a method of growing two different types of crops side by side to reduce the need for fertilisers and feeds. We're growing chickpeas with spring oats, looking at various plant populations and, for us, the effect of those populations on weed suppression. Having been cautious over seed rates and not wanting to run out of the valuable chickpea seed we do have, we have a few seeds left over. It's going to be death by hummus over the summer in the Pawsey household. It was a joy this morning as an organic farmer to greet a Hutchinson's delivery driver in the farmyard. I really felt that I had rejoined the fold. With the muck and mystery of organic and regenerative agriculture these days in biostimulants, microbial inoculants, biofertilisers and other biocontrols, I fear that it may be becoming a more usual occurrence. When I started farming, I used to walk my fields with a young agronomist called Andrew McShane. We started our careers together in this wonderful world of farming. Andrew progressed to chairman of Hutchinson's, whereas I am still walking my fields. I'm sure that there's a lesson in there somewhere. Answers on a postcard, please.
Plug-in solar panels could transform UK energy habits, a story by Netmum's editorial. There is something quietly remarkable at the UK's relationship with the sun. Long the subject of jokes and drizzle-soaked small talk, it has now become a serious player in the country's energy story. Last year, in what turned out to be the sunniest since records began, solar panel edged firmly into the spotlight, and it seems this is only the beginning. A mix of brighter skies and growing enthusiasm from households. Solar energy has reached new heights. Driven both by sunnier weather and growing interest from households, electricity generated by solar panels jumped significantly, reaching nearly 7% of the UK's total supply. Not bad for a technology that, until recently, felt more like a niche experiment than a mainstream solution. The weather, for once, has been on solar's side. With over 1,600 hours of sunshine recorded last year, the conditions were ideal for panels to perform at their best. But sunshine alone does not explain the surge. Behind the numbers sits a clear shift in behaviour. More than 180,000 homes installed solar panels over the year, a sign that householders are no longer simply curious about renewable energy. They are actively investing in it. Rising energy bills have played their part too. With forecasts suggesting costs could climb sharply, many families are looking upwards, quite literally, for relief. Energy companies have noticed. Reports of a sharp rise in solar system sales suggest people are not just dipping a toe, but going all in, opting for larger installations than before. It's a practical decision wrapped in a quiet sense of urgency. Perhaps the most intriguing development is the arrival of simple, more accessible technology. Retailers are preparing to sell plug-in solar panels that require no specialist installation. The idea is refreshingly straightforward, buy, plug in and start generating power. Often referred to as balcony solar, these systems have already gained popularity across parts of Europe. Compact and relatively affordable, they lower the barrier to entry for people who may not have the budget or space for a full rooftop setup. If regulations fall into place, these panels could become as commonplace as a trip down the supermarket aisle. The notion that you might pick up a solar panel alongside your weekly shop would have seemed far-fetched not long ago, yet here we are. While household adoption is driving much of the conversation, larger projects are also shaping the landscape. New solar farms are coming online, contributing to a broader expansion of renewable energy capacity. In fact, solar now accounts for a substantial share of renewable installations, making a shift from the wind-dominated growth seen in previous years. Taken together, renewable sources, including solar, wind and biomass, now provide more than half of the UK's electricity. That milestone alone signals a turning point. The energy mix is changing, and it is happening faster than many expected. There are financial benefits beyond individual savings too. Increased renewable generation has already reduced the need for costly gas imports. At a time when global tensions are pushing fuel prices higher, that kind of resilience is not just welcome, it is essential. What makes this moment particularly interesting is how ordinary it all feels. Solar panel is no longer the preserve of early adopters or eco-enthusiasts. It is becoming part of everyday life, woven into decisions about bills, homes, and even shopping habits. The combination of accessible technology, supportive funding, and a growing awareness of energy costs suggests that this is not a fleeting trend. If anything, the pace is likely to accelerate. And perhaps that is the real shift. Solar energy is no longer about grand promises or distant targets. It is about practical choices made by households across the country, one panel at a time. As it turns out, the British weather may still be unpredictable, but when the sun does shine, it is finally being put to a very good use.
I need to declutter my life, but I can't even give my stuff away, by Adrian Childs in The Guardian. Does anyone want some bits of guttering? They're zinc, I think, free to a good or indeed any home. I'll send them to you, or even, to be on the safe side, deliver them myself, because it would be mad to keep them, although not quite as mad as throwing them away. Please help. I get this a lot, which is why I've got too much stuff. There's stuff I've bought that I shouldn't have. There's stuff that I've bought, used and is now of no use because it's become obsolete or it's conked out. In the case of the guttering, it's the leftovers from a renovation, so not entirely my fault. And always, all around the house, there are random bits and bobs of all shapes and sizes which I could and should get shot of. As a cry to myself for help, I bought a book about decluttering called Clutter's Last Stand. It was quite good, but then, with weary irony, I lost it among the clutter. Perhaps it'll show up one day. I only know one thing, that if I do throw something away thinking I'll never need it, as sure as eggs is eggs, it will turn out to be the very thing I do need. So I have to go out and buy it again, which is the most annoying thing. I get this form of madness from my mum, who keeps everything. For years she held on to the fringes of old-style sheets of postage stamps, just sticky little offcuts of perforated paper. What for? She didn't really know, and neither did I. But then, when one of my daughters was little, she messed up a bit of writing and was upset about it. there were tears. The tipex had been kept so long it had solidified. Despair reigned. Then a light bulb lit up above my mum's head. Aha! Off she went and returned in triumph, bearing the stamp edging. Just the job to stick over the gone wrong writing. But the difference between me and my mum is that while I too might well have kept the stamp edging, there's not a chance in hell I'd have been able to lay my hands upon it when the potential moment of glory presented itself. If you're going to be a hoarder, you'd better be organised, which I am not. I interviewed Dilly Carter, a professional organiser and chief declutterer on the TV show Sort Your Life Out. It's not the kind of thing I watch, but it's a good programme. If you've not heard of it, the team go into someone's house while they're not in and gasp at the general chaos. They then clear the place, taking every bit of stuff to an aircraft hangar where it's spread out over the floor. The householders are then confronted with this spectacle and gasp obligingly. Obviously, as this is television, the gasp is compulsory, but I'd wager most of our jaws would drop if confronted with all our possessions laid out before us. Dilly speaks of the calmness that the clear out can bring you. I get that, and I'd dearly love to unburden myself of at least half of everything I possess. But apart from the fear that I'll one day have a use for the thing I'm binning, the thought of anything going into landfill weighs heavily on my soul. In the brilliant Netflix documentary, Buy Now, The Shopping Conspiracy, Paul Polman, ex-head of Unilever, put it brilliantly when he said that when people talk about throwing stuff away, the problem is that there is no such thing as away. It has to end up somewhere. With clothes especially, we make ourselves feel better about binning them by giving them to charity, which is fine as far as it goes, but there's evidence that charity shops are running out of space. In By Now, we see bales of worthless clothes dumped in the sea off the coast of West Africa. In the episodes of Sort Out Your Life I watched, I heard no mention of landfill. Don't get me wrong, the show makes valuable points about the mindlessness of buying piles of stuff we don't need and how it can end up causing chaos and unhappiness. But all the possessions the householders could be persuaded to bin seem to be earmarked for either reselling, donating, or recycling, rather than for, you know, the bin. Really? I had a bit of a bicker with Dilly about this, but she insisted that if you tried hard enough, you could find a home for almost everything. OK, point taken. Perhaps I've not been putting in the effort. I'll recycle what the council wants to take and, on occasion, visit a dump. But that's about it. Time to stop moaning, lean in and raise my game, starting with the guttering. All this gleaming zinc, some straight, some bent, something for everyone. Surely a good home could be found. I thought about selling it, but this seemed an ambitious project with which to start my eBay career. Instead, I asked the nice bloke from the guttering supplier the builder had used if he'd have it back. He politely declined. I pointed out that he could surely sell it to someone, that I didn't want any money for it, and I'd even take it to him free of charge. Getting slightly hysterical, I reiterated that I just don't want to throw the bloody stuff away. Yeah, it does seem a waste, he replied. And that's the last I heard from him. I'll not be beaten. It's all in the back of my car now, clanking around like nobody's business. You can hear me coming a mile off. A miserable, latter-day Willy Loman, not only failing to make a sale, but unable even to give his wares away.
So that brings us to the end of this edition of The Talking Newspaper. My thanks to all involved in this week's production. Don't forget, we want to hear from you with any comments you have about the recordings. Do call us on Darlington 465 101. If there is no one in the office to answer your call, leave a message and we will get back to you. Or you can email us at dtnewspaper@outlook.com. Until next time, look after yourselves. From me, Pat Walker, and all the team, goodbye.